Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me that we have some students from Port Washington High School. If that's the case, would you please stand? Oh, very nice. You may be seated. Thank you for coming to see us. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar. And they've had an opportunity to hear a little bit about the cases that you're going to argue about this morning. If you can stay after this argument is concluded, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits here to my right, will come down and chat with you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and, I'm sure, a variety of other matters of interest. So if you can stay, please do. All right, the second case of the morning, State versus Coffey. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
I am.
Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nicole Maznica, and I represent the petitioner, Donovan D. Coffey. Before I get into the heart of my remarks, I wanted to point out that I'm aware that this court just heard arguments in the Cunahan matter. I want to be clear from the outset that Cunahan is very different than the case that we have at issue here.
Just don't talk about an opinion. Well, the forfeiture rule comes up in both.
Of course. The forfeiture rule does come up in both cases.
That's right.
But the rights that we're talking about being forfeited, that's where the difference lies.
Right.
In Cunahan, this court is weighing the propriety of a sentencing court considering for the first time new information at a sentencing hearing. There is no argument in that matter that the court considered anything improper or inaccurate or that any misrepresentations were made to the court. That is very different factually than this case. What's at stake for Mr. Coffey is his basic right to be sentenced free from the court's consideration of false and misleading information regarding his character and background. During the state's recitation of Mr. Coffey's criminal record during his sentencing hearing, which otherwise included only two misdemeanor convictions for which he had received probation, the state represented that years prior, in December 2011, it had received a referral that stating that Mr. Coffey had committed an armed robbery offense, the same offense for which he was being sentenced in this case. The state acknowledged that it had not charged that case, but pointed out to the court that it was relevant because it involved a weapon, and it was, of course, a referral for the same offense that was at issue here. That aggravating information was highly misleading to the court. What we now know through the state's submissions during the post-conviction stage is that the 2011 arrest was not for an armed robbery, but actually a robbery, but more importantly, echoing the words of the circuit court in its post-conviction decision, Mr. Coffey did not commit that 2011 armed robbery.
So let me ask, why wouldn't we just expect Mr. Coffey, who's hearing this information, to, you know, raise his hand or maybe lean over to his attorney and say, wait a second, that wasn't me. How come we don't just hold him responsible for that and say that there's no error here because he had an opportunity to do that?
Well, I think if we were to do that, it would be based on assumption only that Mr. Coffey had any sort of information about why he was arrested, why he was released, because this argument wasn't raised until the Court of Appeals. So there's been no evidentiary hearing in this case where Mr. Coffey would have been required to talk about that.
But what if he just said counsel to his defense attorney, I didn't do that one. I didn't do that. Should his attorney then raise his hand and say, oh, excuse me, Judge, my client says he didn't do that?
Well, I think that's a great point because, you know, really it puts a defense attorney in a very, you know, ethically difficult position. Because the situation is, even if your client is factually innocent of something, or they say that they're innocent, a further investigation may not reveal beneficial facts like in this case. This is a really an unusual circumstance. You know, when we raise these issues post-conviction in the typical way in the Tiebelman rubric, it is the defendant's job to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the information is inaccurate. Simply saying, I'm not guilty of this is not enough. So I think that the facts of this case are a little bit different. I also think it's not necessarily a good public policy position to require that this all occur in the middle of a sentencing hearing. Because take, for example, a situation where Mr. Coffey, you know, says, I didn't do this, but it actually was true. He had committed an armed robbery offense. Let's just say that that was actually accurate. I think that it would be contrary to public policy to call upon maybe a circuit court at that point to say, okay, I will not consider that information at this point, because that's something that, of course, would be relevant in a sentencing for an armed robbery if somebody had committed a prior armed robbery. So to ask a circuit court really to what would likely happen in this case, a circuit court would say, well, fine, then I won't consider that information. I don't think that puts us in a better position either, or circuit courts in a better position, because we know that uncharged conduct is certainly relevant. Conduct that really doesn't even necessarily raise to a criminal level, that can be relevant too at sentencing.
But to counsel, don't we want to incentivize these issues to be dealt with as early as possible? I mean, if something inaccurate is raised and the defendant knows that it's inaccurate, why would we set up a procedure that incentivizes the defendant to say anything about that, wait until a post-conviction motion, and then maybe have to redo an entire sentencing? I mean, it seems to me that part of the state's theory is, at least, that this incentivizes dealing with the issues at the best possible time, which is when everybody's present and the trial court can be cleared to not rely on something that we may not be sure it is factually accurate, and that in fact ensures that the defendant's constitutional rights are not violated in the course of a sentencing. Why isn't that a better outcome?
Well, I think, you know, this case is a perfect example of why that sort of position is not really going to remedy the situation. So here the state says, you know, Mr. Coffey's arrested in 2011 for an armed robbery. So imagine Mr. Coffey knows he was arrested. He knows he didn't do an armed robbery, but that's the state says, you know, just take that for what it is, Judge. You know, think about that. If Mr. Coffey, you know, were to tell his attorney, I think that puts an attorney really in a difficult position of whether or not to object. But to ask a defendant to do that, I think, is really improper, because the defendant is not a legally trained person, and they should not be called upon or put in a position where they have to personally object at a sentencing. Problematic, and to expect somebody who is just a litigant or a defendant who's just present here being sentenced for a criminal charge for a felony to stand up and say, Judge, Your Honor, you know, don't think that about me. I didn't do that. I think that's really impractical.
What if the attorney knows?
Well, I think if the attorney does, I think, you know, that potentially could put the parties in a position where, you know, not in Mr. Coffey's case, but in a situation where someone says something is inaccurate, you know, one of two things is going to happen. The matter is going to be adjourned for further investigation. So we're really not saving any sort of time by doing that. You know, if the information that comes forward in the investigation is helpful to the client, then that can be discussed later on at a second subsequent hearing, but still a large portion of time has passed. But it could also come upon, you know, not in this case, of course, but it could be a situation where some negative facts were found out, and then the court ends up finding negative information out that would be harmful to the client, and then that attorney may be in a position where they're going to be called ineffective anyway, so you're creating additional Court of Appeals litigation related to that objection. You know, when we do it in the context of Tiefelman, you know, when we follow that criteria in post-conviction, these matters can be really weeded out by appellate counsel, because we're only raising situations where we can prove by clear and convincing evidence, or at least it's our position we can prove by clear and convincing evidence that the information was inaccurate and that the sentencing court relied upon that information. And there are going to be claims where the client is unhappy with their sentence. And that is certainly not all claims, because this, what we're asking for in this situation is resentencing. Many people will decide not to do that. So the appellate procedure that exists now is already going to be weeding out a host of those claims. And if we require objections while the sentencing hearing is going on, that's going to expand what the litigation that's going on the trial level, and then potentially open up more claims when it reaches the post-conviction and appellate context, because you're going to have a lot more Mockner hearings specifically related to a lack of objection. And you're also going to have Mockner hearings related to an objection that resulted in a defendant, you know, potentially receiving a more harsh sentence, or information that was harmful to their case coming out when it otherwise wouldn't have.
How is that any different from a requirement that you make contemporaneous objections during trial?
Well, there is a requirement that you make contemporaneous objections at trial to certain things, but certain issues are subject to the waiver doctrine, and I think that that's really an important thing to remember. You know, it is my position that forfeiture doesn't apply to these cases. That forfeiture doesn't apply to, when I say these cases too, I should be more specific, cases where a defendant is claiming that the court considered inaccurate information at sentencing. So I don't think forfeiture applies to that.
Right. So would that apply during the trial of the matter?
Well, if inaccurate information came about, well, it depends what the information is, of course. I mean, if you're, because information about the defendant's prior criminal background is not relevant at a sentence or at a trial. So, of course, if that came in, that would be ineffective, but that's a different question that the court would be dealing with because that would be something that's not relevant for a jury's consideration in most, in, right. really in any sort of context in a trial.
But we expect counsel to raise objections during the trial portion, right? I mean, evidence comes in that the that's inappropriate to come in, whether it's a violation of hearsay or because it's not true or whatever it might be. You got to object.
That's correct.
Okay. So why doesn't that apply in the sentencing phase?
Well, I think forfeiture, when we're talking about inaccurate information claims, the federal cases that started really this line of cases that Tiefelman and Travis rely upon, they make it clear how fundamental the right is to be sentenced based upon accurate and reliable information.
Yeah, so let me just stop you right there. Isn't that also true with respect to being convicted?
Well, it depends what you're talking about. Some objections at trial are subject to forfeiture, but some are not, or some rights that are involved in trial are not subject to forfeiture.
Which ones would those be?
So the right, you know, the right to testify, the right against self-incrimination, that's something that waiver is required for in the context of a trial. It doesn't have to come in a formal colloquy, but a defendant has to in some way affirmatively acquiesce its right to either testify or not testify. So that choice is something that is subject to waiver. It can't be forfeited just because the client, if the client doesn't testify, that's not necessarily, you know, dispositive of the issue as far as testimony. That's just one example of that.
Are you distinguishing between inaccurate information at sentencing or inaccurate information that was unknown to the defense at sentencing? Because, I mean, what you're arguing in your response to some of the questions earlier is not just that the defense attorney didn't know here, but that the defendant really didn't, I mean, he knew he didn't do it, but him raising his hand and saying, I didn't do that, really wouldn't have been something that everyone would have said, okay, yeah, they always say that.
Yeah.
Right? But is there a distinction between the fact that really that information wasn't known in this case to defense counsel at all?
I think that is an important distinction. I don't think it's, you know, where the issue rises and falls. My position would be that forfeiture doesn't apply, but that it is possible to waive an issue of inaccurate information at sentencing. I don't think that this would be that situation.
Never being prosecuted for a crime is not necessarily the same as not committing the crime.
Of course.
Right? And so I'm trying to figure out what the state would have this objection look like. And I think, at most, it'd probably look like something where the defense lawyer would say, Judge, this has not been prosecuted. My client would contest that, and we're asking you not to rely on it.
Correct.
Do you think the objection could look like anything else? I mean, we wouldn't require a defendant to make a statement incriminating or even denying the prior allegations, right?
Yes.
So what do you think an objection could look like?
I mean, I think what you're describing, if there was a requirement that there be an objection, I think it would be either, you know, please don't consider this information, or, you know, if the court indicates that they want to know more about this, then I think you have to request an adjournment for further investigation into this information.
I'm trying to figure out what the court could require further information of. I mean, it'd be basically maybe some police reports and uncharged conduct. Courts can consider other acts. Courts can consider uncharged conduct. Courts can consider matters that for which a defendant is found not guilty. In this transcript, how do we know the court relied upon this inaccurate information?
Well, this court specifically stated, you know, when it was talking about the offense itself, you know, it was talking about how did these prior arrests not change your conduct? You know, the court, I think it's in pages 22 to 23, really talks about that, you know, you have this contribution to gun violence in the community. You have, you know, there's this big concern that I have, and I'll have to look at the specifics.
But my question is specific to the one
that you object to now. He did have other criminal conduct for which he was found guilty, right?
He did. He had two misdemeanor convictions, which he pled guilty to.
And what were those convictions for?
One was for a disorderly conduct, a domestic violence charge, and the other was a carrying a concealed weapon.
Okay, so one was a weapons charge and one was a domestic violence.
Correct.
Charge, right? Okay, so how do we know the court wasn't relying on those in imposing sentence?
The court here, we know because the court in the circuit court's decision on the post-conviction motion actually stated that they relied upon these convictions when order, or the 2011 armed robbery allegation when it was sentencing Mr. Coffey, so that we know that the circuit court has acknowledged that in its actual decision.
And what exactly did the court say?
So the court ultimately... The courts ultimately concluded that it did rely upon the information. I'm just looking for the specific language. The court found that this information was also inaccurate, but it was the court who stated that the information was harmless. So that's why the court ultimately decided the motion or denied the motion. They pointed to other facts basically in the record to support its decision, which is why this matter was appealed, because there's clear case law that states that you cannot just point to other factors in the record or point or justify the sentence and say that it would have been, you know, the sentence would have likely been the same. You can't do that. That's Welch versus Lane, a Seventh Circuit case. So that's why this matter ultimately ended up on appeal. There was no forfeiture argument in the circuit court, and nobody proceeded that way at the time.
So what would resentencing actually get your client under these facts? The actual language that the court used when he considered the post-conviction motion was, although the court considered the December 2011 incident during its sentencing decision, the court focused primarily on the defendant's conduct in this case, his contribution to the prevalence of gun violence that is threatening the fabric of our community, the impact of his crimes, I'm adding on these words, in this case, upon the victims and the greater community, and then went on to cite other factors that the court considered. He then said, even without information about the December 2011 police contact, the fact that the defendant used a weapon in the commission of the offenses and that he shot one of his victims would have led the court to the same conclusion on sentencing. So let's say the court said, okay, I'll give you a resentencing. It wouldn't have made a difference, and that's why the court went on to say the error was harmless because it did not materially affect the court's sentencing decision. So is this just an exercise in the court going through what he actually did in the post-conviction proceedings to say you get the same sentence and these are the factors I'm relying on now?
I mean, I think that could potentially be a result in any situation where you're asking for resentencing, but I think that that's not permissible under Welch versus Lane. That's, you know, when in that case when they're talking about, you know, harmlessness, they specifically state that it's only speculation that the court can say what the, you know, that they would have ordered the exact same sentence.
No, what I'm saying is what would resentencing have gotten you in this case, because the judge, we know on the post-conviction motion in response, said I would have given the same sentence. Let's say instead of denying the motion, he said, okay, I'm going to give you, Mr. Coffey, resentencing. Isn't the result here pretty much going to be the same? One of the things I would be concerned about is that this is a tactical decision that's made after a rotation. We're in Milwaukee County here. The judges rotate. So is this could this be used as an attempt by defendants to get another judge to look at the case and perhaps give a more lenient sentence?
I mean, I think you could always look at any sort of post-conviction challenge like that, whether you're trying for a new trial or a new sentencing, but I think the fundamental rights are the same. It doesn't mean, you know, because the same thing could happen in this case, doesn't mean that Mr. Coffey didn't have a substantial violation of his right to be sentenced based only upon fair and accurate information.
Well, let me go back to my original question. I think it was Judge Rosa in this case. Let's say he grants the resentencing. Is there any doubt in your mind that your client would have gotten the same sentence? Because Judge Rosa said, I would have given the same sentence, and here's why. Even if I didn't look at the December 2011 police contact.
I mean, I don't know that he doesn't say I would have given the exact sentence. He says I was primarily relying upon it. He said it didn't materially affect the way I saw the case. I think that it's completely speculative to say, you know, because he can't unwrite what he heard about the prior conduct. I think it's after the fact, you know, what Welch versus Lane talks about, after the fact, when you say, you know, the sentence would have been the same, that's problematic because that's really speculative because the court's opinion at the outset was tainted by, you know, the initial misinformation. So I think it's really, you know, when we're looking at it retrospectively and say that's basically the same as saying there's all these other factors in the record that support, you know, that level of sentence that I got. Certainly Mr. Coffey would never be arguing that his case isn't serious. He received a substantial sentence and he, you know, wants to have a new sentencing hearing so that he's able to, you know, really have a fair sentencing procedure where the court considers exactly his prior criminal record, his prior conduct. And I don't think you can excise something, especially something this serious, because absent this, his prior conduct is two misdemeanor convictions where he received probation for each. He was highly cooperative in this offense. That's all, you know, relayed in the sentencing transcript. But this is something that the court notes throughout the sentencing remarks and says this was serious.
Then you're suggesting that the same judge not do the resentencing, that the defendant under these circumstances would be entitled to have a new judge do the sentencing, do the next sentencing, because what I'm hearing you say is that since this judge heard and knew about and admitted to relying on the December 2011 police contact, I think you just said he can't excise that from his knowledge for purposes of resentencing. So are you asking us to implement a rule that under these circumstances, if we agree that there should have been a resentencing, the defendant's entitled to a different judge to perform that sentencing?
No, I'm not asking for that rule. What I'm talking about is if you have a resentencing hearing, we're taking the armed robbery arrest out of it. So that looks very differently. You know, defense counsel would be prepared to argue about this, be prepared to argue about Mr. Coffey's character. Maybe the argument would have looked very different had, you know, during the state's recitation of his prior criminal record or prior background, he learns, Mr. Coffey has potentially this other 2011 arrest. Maybe he was planning to say, you know, this is an aberration. You know, this is like one horrific incident. And then he hears, there might be this other thing out there. We don't know that the sentencing, you know, we can read the transcript and say, you know, this is likely what would have occurred, but the defense argument could have been completely different. The court's thoughts on the case could have been completely different.
Counsel, doesn't Tiepelman tell us to do exactly that, though? I mean, I understand your argument that essentially, how do we know, you know, that some measure of clairvoyance that we're supposed to have as a court, but that's exactly what the harmless error analysis is. It can make me a little uncomfortable, I suppose, to try to figure out what would have happened. But, I mean, the state, to Justice Bradley's point, is making the argument that even if you took this out, as best we can tell, the sentence would have been the same. And we certainly can rely on the fact that the judge who did the sentencing said exactly that, that that's certainly a strong consideration. It's speculation, sure, but that's what harmless error is. It's speculation.
I mean, I don't think that's what Tiepelman's telling us to do. Tiepelman cites Welch versus Lane, and Welch versus Lane specifically states, quote, the fact that other information might have justified the sentence independent of the inaccurate information is irrelevant when deciding whether the court has relied upon the inaccurate information as part of the basis of the sentence.
I thought that, you know, the trial court's argument here on post-conviction and really the state's argument is this was mentioned a couple of times, it was not highlighted significantly, acknowledging the first two points that it was inaccurate and relied upon, right? It was clearly mentioned. But that the argument was the trajectory from committing some misdemeanors and domestic violence and those sorts of things built up to now, you know, a crime of significant violence with a firearm, that trajectory was still the same even if you took that police contact out. And even if the notation was not accurate about it, it was still the comments, the thrust were the same. It wouldn't have led to a change in discretion. That's really our harmless error argument, isn't it?
I mean, that's a potential argument. I think that's exactly what Welch versus Lane is trying to protect against, because to argue that hearing about an armed robbery offense, a prior armed robbery that would have occurred in an armed robbery sentencing, you know, to say that is meaningless. I mean, in my practice, before I became an appellate attorney, I was a trial attorney and did, you know, hundreds, if not 1,000 sentencings. This would be information that was highly relevant to a court at sentencing, something a defense attorney certainly would have wanted to know about prior, but this only was in the state's file. The state held this information, didn't disclose it to anyone until at the sentencing hearing. This information wasn't even in the Criminal Information Arrest Bureau report kept by the Department of Justice. So this is a situation where we're saying how unfair it is and, you know, that there are concerns about, you know, harmlessness and all of that. When what we're really talking about is that Mr. Coffey did not have a fair sentencing procedure here. You know, Tiepelman talks about that a fair sentencing process, constitutionally sound process, is one in which the court selects an appropriate sentence based only upon accurate and reliable information. Here we're talking about a very significant aggravating factor that the court acknowledged it considered in its post-conviction decision. And we're trying to say that that was harmless. I don't see how that could possibly, that seems to be almost, aside from the facts of the case, the most important part of Mr. Coffey's background that the court considered at sentencing. He talks about it, the sentencing court discusses it on multiple occasions, says, you know, how come you haven't learned from these prior arrests? I don't think you can excise the prior arrest for an armed robbery where the state's representing he probably got away with it, is basically what the allegation is, that something rose to the level of probable cause, but I decided, you know, the state decided not to charge it. I don't know how you can excise that and say that this caused no harm for Mr. Coffey, that the court didn't consider this at all when ordering sentence and that the sentence would have been identical. That would be purely speculative.
To follow up on Justice Hagedorn's question, aren't you then suggesting that there should be no harmless error analysis at all?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think we could certainly talk about that there's inaccuracies that wouldn't affect at all a sentencing court's decision. I mean, take potentially like an inaccuracy about an offense itself. You know, if we're talking about somebody was hit 10 times versus 11 times.
Right. But, I mean, the harmless error analysis presupposes that the court relied on the information in developing the sentence, right?
Correct. Right. I'm sorry, the red light is on.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
In the harmless error analysis then goes on to say that even though the court relied on that in developing the sentence, that error was harmless. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. And in this circumstance, it seems like you're suggesting that if the court relied on it, right, actually influenced the sentence, that cannot be subject to a harmless error analysis.
I'm not suggesting that. Should I discuss this in my rebuttal? Or?
Yes, that's good. Okay.
Right, thank you. I will address that in my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill on behalf of the state. The state is asking this court to reach two main conclusions in this case. The first is for the court to clarify that the well-established rule that an appellate claim can be forfeited by a party's failure to contemporaneously object to the error applies to a claim that a circuit court sentenced the defendant based on inaccurate information. The second thing that the state is asking for is for this court to apply that rule in this case and conclude that the defendant forfeited his appellate review of his claim that the circuit court sentenced him based on an inaccurate information about his prior arrest.
Counsel, what harm is there to the state if a defendant doesn't object during sentencing? In this case, he knew that it wasn't him, Mr. Coffey, knew it wasn't him. It also wasn't an armed robbery. I think it's a strong armed robbery, so there wasn't a weapon that was involved, which is often very significant in sentencing. But it's very difficult to go through all of that at the moment of sentencing. What harm is there to the state if it's simply raised in a post-sentencing motion?
The harm, first of all, I think the overall harm is to the judicial process and to the interest of having some finality in a conviction based on, the evidence that was introduced at the sentencing hearing. As to the state's prejudice, the state's entitled to rely on that finality and to believe that the sentence was entered appropriately.
But we have all sorts of post-conviction motions that come up. some objecting to a lot of things during the course of trial, and certainly there's a provision made for a post-conviction motion if there was an error at sentencing. I just don't see the great harm to the state, though I can see, you know, there are some trial judges, if you interrupt them, they're going to be annoyed with you. We
Absolutely.
All have different personalities. There are some trial judges that if you tell them at the end of sentencing, they will have thought a lot about it before they got to sentencing, and you're not apt to change their mind at that moment. They may welcome the opportunity to rethink it at a post-sentencing motion. I just don't see why the state is short-circuited there at all.
I think, again, the state has a reliance interest on the sentence that's entered.
Say that again.
A reliance interest on the sentence that was entered. The state, once a judgment's entered, the state should have a belief that the judgment was appropriately entered. And there's also, of course, the time and effort necessary to respond to post-conviction proceedings.
Okay, but with all due respect, it's the state that put forward inaccurate information. So your request for finality isn't well received by me because it's the state's fault that we're even here because the state put forward inaccurate information. So you need a better answer than the state wants finality in providing inaccurate information to a
sure.
court.
And I was speaking generally about applying the forfeiture rule to the inaccurate information claims, not necessarily with the specifics of this case. The fact that the state did introduce the inaccurate information may be a reason to overlook the forfeiture rule in this case. Although I would say that the state's inaccuracy here, I don't see anything in the record that suggests it was anything other than an honest, good faith mistake.
I'm not saying it's dishonest. I'm just
sure.
saying if
Absolutely.
It presented accurate information to the court, we might not be here.
Correct. And if the defendant had objected, we might not be here as well.
Well, wait a sec. Let's play that out. Objection look like? Let me just ask. I asked opposing counsel the same thing. What would that objection in your mind look like? You can't say, oh, I committed a strong arm robbery, even though I wasn't charged, but I didn't, but I didn't do an armed robbery. You can't require that of a defendant.
Yeah.
So is it just I object because you shouldn't consider this and we can't tell you why?
The objection in this case should have been, once the state said he had a 2011 arrest for armed robbery, something should have been gone off in counsel's head or the defendant's head saying, wait a minute, that's not true.
Well, that is true. He did have a 2011 arrest.
We,
so what's the defendant supposed to say? I mean, it wasn't him. He was misidentified. So he's supposed to raise his hand and say, sorry, that wasn't, you know, they didn't charge me because they actually identified someone else as having done that. I mean, how is he supposed to get involved?
I think we have to look at, too, the information that would have been available to defense counsel. I don't know exactly what defense counsel did here. If defense counsel pulled the defendant's CIB report, if defense
they
counsel
They don't have had, information about no process cases. They
right.
know that he wasn't charged, but they don't know why. Those are notes that you know are privileged.
I agree with that, and but had counsel pulled the CIB report, he would have seen that there was nothing from 2011 on that report and could have objected then. I'm not saying that counsel had to object and say he wasn't arrested for armed robbery versus strong arm robbery in 2011. Counsel could have said, wait a minute, I don't have any record of this. What is the state relying on to put forth this information? Had counsel done that, the state could have then come forward with the police report and this would have all been resolved, if not immediately at sentencing, because I don't know what information the prosecutor had available at sentencing, but this could have been resolved sooner than a post-conviction motion.
Let's just say it was him, but he wasn't prosecuted for it. Then what would you do with the information?
I'm not sure I understand your...
Let's say that instead of it being a misidentification, it really was him, but he wasn't prosecuted for it.
The only information that I think that was inaccurate before the circuit court was that Mr. Coffey was arrested... and it was an arrest for an armed robbery. The correct information is he was arrested for a strong armed robbery. There was no dispute that he wasn't prosecuted. So,
isn't the inaccurate information the fact that someone else was identified for that crime? We're not. You can consider arrests at sentencing. So to say that a judge is not going to consider an arrest, that's not true. They can, and they do. But the issue here is not just that he was arrested. It's the fact that he was not identified as the person who committed the crime, and someone else probably was arrested for it, not him. That's the inaccurate information, right?
I don't believe so. I think the information is that the defendant was arrested for this crime. I don't interpret the police reports in the same way that the defendant does.
Are the police reports in the record?
They are. They're attached to the state's response. All we have is the defendant, if I may.
While you're looking for that, would it be appropriate for the state to suggest that a proper sentencing factor would be that he was arrested for a crime, state knows that someone else was actually convicted for it. So the state knows that the person did not actually, would be appropriate for the state to suggest that?
Before we address your question, can we have counsel answer Justice Dallet's question, that he went and got the police report?
And I don't see the police report, so maybe you can read that to us. Or I can try to look it on the
computer. It's in the state's response to the post-conviction motion. Unfortunately, on my copy, the docket number
is the state's
cut
response
off.
To the post-conviction motion is actually not accurate. And I have the police report in front of me, so to expedite my colleague's questions on this point, I will note that the police report says that one of the victims stated the suspect with the dreadlocks had tattoos on his arms. It should be noted that the suspect arrested for this incident, Donovan Coffey, does have dreadlocks. However, he does not have tattoos on his arms, and the lieutenant instructed the sergeant to administratively release Coffey.
So it wasn't him. He doesn't have tattoos on his arms. Isn't that the inaccurate information? Forget what this crime is called, strong-arm robbery, right? Isn't that what we're talking about? Isn't that why this case is, like, important here?
The victim said the defendant didn't, or the person who robbed him didn't have tattoos, doesn't mean that it wasn't Mr. Coffey. He was arrested close to the scene of the crime. He was arrested in a building that the victim, I believe he was arrested in a building that the victim said that he saw the people who robbed him go into. If the victim didn't completely and accurately identify the person who robbed him, it doesn't mean that wasn't a crime that Mr. Coffey committed, and that the circuit court couldn't at least properly rely on at sentencing for the purposes that it did, that he had an arrest.
Okay. The victim also...
Justice Kelly can get back in, because he stopped a minute for you. Justice Kelly, do you still have
thank
your
you.
Question?
Yes, thank you. Let me just set up the structure here then. So let's say that Mr. Coffey was arrested for this, but not prosecuted because the state found out it wasn't him. Would it be appropriate for the state to nonetheless introduce the arrest in the sentencing procedures?
I believe your earlier question, I don't know if you said it again, if someone else had been convicted or arrested or for the crime, or I'm sorry.
So he's arrested.
Yes.
But he's not prosecuted because the state found out, well, it wasn't him, it was some other guy, right? So would it be nonetheless appropriate for the state to introduce that arrest in Mr. Coffey's sentencing hearing?
If the state knew that Mr. Coffey was not the person and that's why they didn't prosecute the case, then, I think that would be inappropriate for the state to...
And if the state had read the police report, the state would have read that one of the victims stated that after Coffey and the alleged co-actor were arrested and brought out of the house, they being the victims, were then able to see their faces and determined that Coffey and the alleged co-actor were not involved in this incident.
Yes.
Yeah, so... Why did the state bring this up in the sentencing hearing at all?
The state brought it up because it thought it was relevant. Again, I don't think the police report, just because the victims say after the fact, when the police present the defendants...
Let me turn it around a little bit differently.
Yeah.
On what basis does the state believe that Mr. Coffey was actually involved in the thing for which he was arrested? Do you have any basis for believing that he was involved?
It's in the police report. The information is that he was arrested for this crime.
Yeah, he was arrested for it, but that has nothing to do with whether he actually did it, right? Does the state have any information that would suggest to the state that he actually did it?
I think if you look at the police report, again, my recollection, and I'm sorry, I don't want to misstate anything there, but my recollection is that the robbery was reported. The victim said the people who robbed us went into this nearby building. The police then went in the building and pulled Mr. Coffey and his accomplice and the and another person, excuse me, out. So there is a basis to believe that they were involved with the robbery.
What, because he was in an adjacent building?
The building that the victim saw him go into.
But the issue is not whether the police had a basis to arrest him. The issue is whether the state had a basis for including this information in its sentencing remarks when it knew that the police administratively released Coffey because the victim, in so many words, said, that's not him. The victim, the report goes on to talk about how the victim talked about the tattoos and the victim wasn't sure. You know, he couldn't remember all what the tattoos were, but Coffey doesn't have tattoos or didn't at the time, so he was administratively released. And also, what is also troubling, I think, to me and perhaps some of my other colleagues is that in the state's post-conviction motion response, it continued on to insist that he was arrested for armed robbery, and that was just not true.
That is inaccurate. Yes.
Counsel, I want to get back to the test. You started at the get-go before we got into this interesting line of questions that any objection should be made contemporaneously. You want to, number one, clarify that it should be, in order to enhance appellate review, contemporaneous objection. So what do you mean by contemporaneous? Because in pages 9 and 10 of your brief, you say, maybe not so contemporaneous.
Sure.
You say, look, if the state raises it initially, as are the facts in this case, or if a judge raises inaccurate information, sui sponte, it's okay for any objection to be made either way at the very end of the sentencing hearing. So that's not so contemporaneous to me, especially vis-a-vis the state's initially raising it. To wait, you know, you heard the oral arguments in the prior case because I saw you, and there was some suggestion that maybe it would be a little different for an attorney because it's the opportunity then to speak, and so the attorney from the state would at sentencing speak first, and the response then comes from the attorney for the defendant, and arguably has an attorney has an opportunity to respond to whatever information is being the subject of the inquiry. But in your brief on pages 9 and 10, you say, even that can wait until the very end of the sentencing hearing. So how contemporaneous is contemporaneous?
Contemporaneous enough. Just
like Goldilocks, you know. Just right. Well, that's not good enough.
Sure. So contemporaneous enough that the court has the opportunity to do something about the error, if the court is, in fact, the one who made the error. Contemporaneous enough so that the state's misstatement can be corrected, and that doesn't have to be immediately during the state's sentencing presentation. It can be during the defendant's sentencing presentation, saying, I take issue with whatever the state said. If you look at the purposes of the forfeiture rule, it's to avoid unnecessary litigation after the fact. It's to give courts the opportunity to fix their mistakes or to avoid them altogether.
Counsel, and you may have heard me ask this in the last arguments as well, but I'm trying to get my mind around exactly what the law statement, the test would be on this rule, just to follow up on that you're proposing, of what exactly needs to be objected to. Is your argument that any Tiepelman-type claim must be objected to during the hearing? Does it matter what the defendant knows? Does it matter what counsel knows? Does it matter whether the inaccurate information is something presented prior to the court pronouncing sentence or a claim based on what the court says at sentence? And if you could work through those issues for me and then maybe as precisely as possible put forward what you would like this court to write as a suggested forfeiture rule, what that would look like.
Sure. Our position is that the objection has to come during the sentencing hearing. Ideally, it comes as soon as the inaccuracy comes into existence, basically. If it's the state saying something inaccurate in its remarks, or if it's something in the PSI, it should be corrected when the PSI is discussed or in response to the state's remarks. I don't think a contemporaneous objection to interrupt the state's sentencing argument is necessary. If it is something that the court comes up with that hasn't been previously discussed by either of the parties, then our position is that the objection either has to come during the court's sentencing explanation or immediately afterwards.
What about information here that they didn't know they didn't know? So it is true he was arrested. So to say that the objection needed to be made, he wasn't arrested, that's not what wasn't true. It's that he didn't do it. So what about something that you don't know? And defense attorney wasn't given it by the state, wouldn't have had the access to try to find it even.
Right.
What about that situation?
Well, for something that nobody could truly know, I think that might fall into more of a new factor analysis rather than inaccurate information analysis. But here, I take issue with the idea that defense counsel shouldn't have known, or the defendant should have known anything about this. It's, as I think I explained earlier, had counsel been aware of the defendant's CIB report, he would have known there was nothing from 2011 on that. That would have been a red flag for counsel to make an objection and say, well, wait a minute, what are you relying on? The point of the forfeiture rule is to give an opportunity to fix mistakes before they happened.
Can I just clarify something in my mind? There's the inaccuracy regarding strong arm robbery and armed robbery.
Correct.
The statement was made at sentencing regarding armed robbery, and that's inaccurate because even the arrest was for strong arm robbery, which is
correct.
Different, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so the state concedes that that is inaccurate,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Is the state also conceding that Mr. Coffey could not have been charged because it wasn't him? I'm hearing my colleagues say that, and I'm not sure that was a concession that you made. He may not have been charged, but I know there was not an ID.
Right.
But I've seen people be charged where IDs are questionable. That doesn't necessarily mean someone couldn't be charged. So are you also conceding that he is not guilty of this offense or that he would not be charged because they had the wrong guy?
We're not conceding that. Unfortunately, the record isn't, completely developed about why this case wasn't prosecuted.
Then let me ask you briefly. Let's just assume, and this is what I was trying to get at before, and I don't know if it pertains to Mr. Coffey or not, but it might some other defendant. A person is being sentenced for which the state references an arrest, for which that person was never charged, tried, or convicted. But that person leans over and says to his lawyer, I did that. I don't want to talk about it. What's that objection supposed to look like when it's contemporaneous? Or he doesn't lean over and say that to the lawyer, but the lawyer objects. They don't want to be talking about that, and they don't have to incriminate the defendant. So what's the objection look like if it has to be so contemporaneous? Why not give people some room to breathe a little bit, figure out what's going on, and file their motions if they need to?
So we're talking about a claim, though, where there is unquestionably a basis to object, and it's not taken.
What's the objection look like? Maybe the lawyer doesn't want to get into this other than say, objection, Your Honor, this wasn't charged. He hasn't been convicted. You really shouldn't consider it at all, right?
Yeah.
That's a different objection than objection, Your Honor, not my client, didn't do it, was really, he may,
sure.
The lawyer may not know at that point in time what the objection looks like. And some might hurt his client. Some might help his client.
Sure.
And I'm just using the facts here. So using the he's and she's and not trying to offend anybody. So just help me out with what the objection needs to look like if it must be so contemporaneous.
It's going to depend on the facts of the case, and it's going to depend on why counsel wants to object.
Again, do you see how that sets defense counsel up for an ineffective assistance of counsel argument later, no matter what the lawyer does, unless the lawyer knows everything and makes the right objection at that point in time?
Sure. Well, I mean, the objection, the idea of an objection that would keep relevant information from a sentencing court, I don't know if that's deficient performance. We don't have an expectation that relevant information is kept from a sentencing court. You know, counsel makes a blunder that, you know, keeps the court, you know, doesn't object, or and it keeps the court, excuse me, doesn't object and keeps the court from considering information that hurt his client. And only later comes back and is claimed, you know, maybe to be ineffective. I don't think that's really the situation we're looking at. But again, I think the objection would look like, what could have counsel been reasonably expected to do?
And see, I think your rule makes defense lawyers have a very difficult job being honest with the court and being true to their client when they don't know what they don't know.
Sure, but that, I think, goes to why didn't counsel know what he didn't know? And I, you know, again, we don't know exactly what defense counsel did here because there hasn't been a claim of ineffective assistance. There hasn't been a Mockner hearing. We don't know what preparation counsel did. But I think we can at least assume from the record that counsel had no idea that there was this 2011 arrest, and he was surprised by it at the sentencing hearing. If that's the case, that is something that could have been avoided, that because counsel could, again, gotten the CIB report and realized that this Mr. Coffey's criminal history began in 2012 and said, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? Ultimately, the goal of sentencing is to have reliable and accurate information before the circuit court. And that, you know, the state made a mistake here, but that mistake was compounded by the defendant's failure to say anything about it.
I'm confused by you keep saying CIB reports.
Yeah.
We never saw CIB reports. We have CCAP as a statewide, and sometimes if it's outside of the state, you have another report potentially, but not necessarily, and it's not something that necessarily would have been received. So I don't...
Not the circuit court, the defense counsel. Post-conviction counsel obtained the defendant's CIB report after the fact. You know, I don't know what else defense counsel did or didn't do to learn the defendant's criminal history.
Okay, but arrests aren't necessarily reported on
correct.
That, and they are sometimes, and they aren't reported on anything on CCAP yet they've could have still been arrested. So again, how would the defense attorney have known?
Arrests can make it onto CIB reports, although, as I think the post-conviction court indicated in a footnote in its decision, it said, I don't know why it wasn't included. But again, if defendant's history on his report starts in 2012 and the state brings up something from 2011, I think that's a red flag to defense counsel, who at least was prepared and knew his client's arrest history or his criminal history.
So is there something here, though, that you would at least concede that that applies differently because it's the state that did it? Because last I checked, if the state is planning on using information, they're supposed to turn it over to defense, and they clearly didn't turn this over. So is there some piece of this that you would put on a different rule, perhaps?
I would concede that under the facts of this case, that may be a reason not to apply the forfeiture rule. If it's because the state didn't give the base information to the defendant, and if the state was the source of the inaccurate information, again, I don't think that there was any intention intentionally misleading the court. It was a good faith mistake by the court. But under perhaps the circumstances of this case and other cases where the state's the source of the information, that might be a basis for the court exercising its discretion to overlook forfeiture. I don't think that's what should happen here, though, because, again, I think an objection was possible and an objection wasn't made.
Just getting back again about this on the rule here. So just make sure I understand it. You are proposing that in just Tiepelman claims, inaccurate information claims, that forfeiture be applied, not other types of sentencing errors. I mean, there are other types of complaints about a sentence that courts see all the time that might occur even when the court's handing down a sentence. Tiepelman includes some of those types of, you know, Tiepelman claims could include that. Sometimes they might not. But you're saying for any type of Tiepelman claim, we ought to apply forfeiture. Is that right?
Say that it is they can be forfeited. It you know, again, doesn't have to be forfeited.
Sure. Obviously, it's a rule of judicial administration, but I mean from a starting point. But did I just hear you make an exception when the state is either the cause of it or when the state didn't turn over information? Are you accepting those types of claims when the default rule would be forfeiture?
It's going to always depend on the circumstances, and it's ultimately whether to apply forfeiture is whether it's fair to the defendant.
Well, I understand whether to apply it or not. As a court, we're tasked with sort of setting out a sort of default rule, and obviously whether lower courts choose to apply forfeiture or not is an important question, but maybe a different question over when these claims should be properly raised, and so. Are you advocating that forfeiture should always be the rule in these cases, but maybe courts should not apply it in these situations? Or are you arguing that forfeiture should not be the default rule in all Tiepelman cases, that maybe there's some exceptions to what the default rule would be?
The default rule should be that these claims can be forfeited, and if there is no objection, they are forfeited. The Court of Appeals and the Circuit Courts, when assessing these cases, I think, as my colleague said earlier in her argument, we can trust circuit courts and the Court of Appeals to know under the circumstances when it's fair to overlook a forfeiture, when it's not reasonable to expect a defendant to object. That is something the Court of Appeals, it does routinely in inaccurate information claims, and it does, and of course, in other forfeited claims as well.
But they look to us, though, for guidance. What kind of guidance should we give them in answering that inquiry?
The guidance should be that these claims are subject to forfeiture. The case law...
But whether or not to apply forfeiture.
Whether or not, I think, whether or not you can guide the courts by saying it depends on the facts of the case and whether
that's not much guidance.
And whether it's reasonable to have expected the defendant to object, whether there was an opportunity, when the inaccurate information came into play, all sorts of those factors are all going to matter. And yes, I think that the state was the source of the information, obviously, should be one of those as well.
If we don't apply forfeiture here, we have similar facts under the Travis case where the circuit court, there was an error in sentencing, and the circuit court looked at it post-conviction and said, I would have imposed the same sentence regardless of the inaccurate information. And here we have that sort of retrospective review. Now, in the Travis case, the court did not accept and apply the circuit court's retrospective review and, in fact, granted resentencing. What makes this case different about Travis? Why should we accept what the circuit court concluded, that he would have given the same sentence?
I think you have to look at how the court used the inaccurate information here, and the court's point was that this defendant was engaging in an escalating pattern of behavior that ultimately led up to the crimes at issue in this case. That was how the court used the information that the defendant had been arrested for armed robbery. That remains true whether or not the defendant was arrested for armed robbery. I think that remains true whether the defendant was arrested for strong arm robbery. We don't have to, even without considering whether exactly the state could have proven this charge had it gone forward with the prosecution. The defendant had some misdemeanor convictions, including for using a weapon, and he, in this case, he robbed somebody, and somebody was shot. So that court's point about the defendant's escalating behavior remains true regardless of whether that information was inaccurate or not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, there was a post-sentencing motion, and there was a hearing, and we have a written transcript, not a transcript, actually. It's the order from the circuit court. Would you like to address harmless error and why we shouldn't apply that in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. And that it was also Justice Kelly's question, too, right before we took the break. I believe in this situation that harmlessness is, of course, the appropriate review. I don't believe that there aren't situations that could be harmless, but certainly not harmless here. I think what the court is doing in its post-conviction decision, and it's really sort of doing what's what was talked about in Tiepelman, when we're referring back to the Court of Appeals cases in that, in Tiepelman. Tiepelman talks about, and the idea of Tiepelman was clarifying for the Court of Appeals that had been improperly applying the reliance test. They had been applying prejudicial reliance instead of actual reliance. And Tiepelman talks about that, you know, that we don't need prejudice to come in here because we already have harmlessness, and harmlessness is a different standard than prejudice. So Tiepelman ultimately says, you know, all that the defendant has to prove is that the information's inaccurate and that the court relied upon it, actually relied upon it. So use that at some point during its sentencing by referencing it. Then the state must prove that it was harmless. And harmlessness is different than proving, you know, where the defense would have to prove prejudice. The state has to prove that the information did not affect the sentencing. They have to prove, basically, beyond a reasonable doubt that the sentence would have been the same absent the consideration of the inaccurate information. I think there are going to be situations where that could happen. The inaccurate information could be something, you know, if some, you know, talking about some prior criminal record, maybe saying they got probation in this case. But maybe the probation was revoked, and the court might have mentioned that, but maybe it had never actually been revoked. You know, something where it's a minor consideration, where the court maybe just touches on something, but it's not really the root of the entirety of the sentencing hearing. The court references the criminal background multiple times in this situation. You know, the court's talking about the defendant's contribution to gun violence in the community. We can't say that he's talking about the CCW charge. I think possible to retrospectively state that that he was giving no consideration to the armed robbery case there, or I'm sorry, the robbery arrest.
Well, counsel, wasn't the court relying on the arrest as a data point in establishing that Mr. Coffey was becoming involved in increasingly serious misconduct? Yes? Isn't that the basis of the court used that arrest?
I mean, the court does say increasingly serious conduct, but I don't think we can properly excise or know exactly what the court was thinking, because we know that the court was relying upon that conviction. The court has acknowledged that.
Yeah, but I mean, so maybe he was just using that as a data point in that rationale. You're engaging in increasingly serious misconduct. And that remains true even without considering the arrest, right?
That may remain true, but it may change the court's decision on sentencing. Somebody having a prior misdemeanor conviction and now having a serious felony conviction, of course, that's increasing seriousness. But hearing about a defendant who had really escaped prosecution, gotten lucky, because the court does specifically say, how come these prior arrests didn't affect you? He doesn't say prior convictions. He says, how come these prior arrests didn't affect you? And you know, why didn't that cause you to change your conduct in the future? The court says that and then goes into the increasingly, your increasing criminal conduct.
That part could be completely accurate without respect to whether he actually did anything wrong, right?
It could be, but we don't know. That's the problem that Welch talks about, that we can't go on a retrospective hunt to justify the facts that a sentencing – or justify a specific sentence to the court or that the court arrived upon, because we don't know if it impacted the court at all in its selection of sentence.
So I'm kind of getting back to the question I asked you the first time around, which is, well, then how in the world could the state ever prove harmlessness? I mean, it seems like you're asking for some kind of metaphysical certainty that the sentence would have been the same. And that's not the standard, right?
I mean, no, it's beyond a reasonable doubt that the sentence would be the same.
Right. So we look at this and we say, all right, here are the two bases on which the court used this arrest. He says, you were arrested. Shouldn't that have taught you something, right? Well, yeah, it should have taught him something regardless of what the arrest was for. And then the second part that he relied on was that you're engaging in increasingly serious misbehavior. And that's certainly true, given what he was convicted for and what he was being sentenced for. That demonstrates that, in fact, he was engaging in that. So if we look at both of those bases that the court used that data point to support, both of those bases are undoubtedly true, why is that not harmless?
Chief Justice, I see that my red light's on.
Yes, you may answer his question.
Well, I think when we're talking about harmlessness, it's not an easy thing for the state to prove, and I don't think we should consider that it should be an easy thing. When you look at Tiepelman, Travis, Welch, they're talking about things that are potentially less serious and aggravating than what occurred in this case. The difference between criminal arrests and convictions. The difference in Welch is the difference between a criminal conviction for a robbery and an armed robbery. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit said, you talked about that, that's not harmless. That's what the state, or I'm sorry, the government had argued because it was a federal case. We can't just guess that what had impacted the sentence. We have to look at the language that was used, the seriousness of the inaccuracy, and in this situation, it's clear that it affected the outcome of the case. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. The arguments were very good, and the briefs were very good as well. I don't know if you students can stay or not. If you can, will you tell our marshal and then communicate with Justice Bradley, and if you can stay, she'll be out to chat with you a little bit later. But the court is adjourned until 1:30.
Great. Test, 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 test. Good volume. Sounds good to me.
But now just pull your...
Right. So now it's not even picking up right over here. Yeah. So test, test right here. Okay.
Yep.
Good. Thank you.